Hi, this is Catherine, just dropping in to say hi and to tell you that both Kate and I have newsletters. My newsletter is called Highbrow, Lowbrow, Mediumbrow, and hers is called The Bowerbird. Both are on Substack. We'll put links on the First Time Instagram feed and on our website, and we would love if you would subscribe. Thank you.
Happy summertime, First Time listeners, or happy wintry new year to our listeners in the Northern Hemisphere. My name is Kate Mildenhall, and my co-host here at the First Time podcast, Catherine Collette, and I are both at the beach. Maybe some of you are too, but we wanted to give you some ear happiness over our break. So we've put together our top 10 episodes ever for you to revisit and get you inspired for a new year of writing and reading and creativity. Welcome to our summer series. Happy summer and happy listening. The First Time podcast records on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and future. This always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Benjamin Law is the author of The Family Law, Geyser, the quarterly essay Moral Panic 101, and editor of Growing Up Queer in Australia. He created and co-wrote three seasons of the award-winning SBS TV series The Family Law and wrote the sold-out MTC play Torch the Place. He co-hosts Stop Everything on the ABC's Radio National and interviews public figures for Good Weekend.
Welcome, Ben. This is the master series of the First Time podcast. We are not sure about the name, but basically the essence of it is that we're talking to really established authors that we've always wanted to talk to. And for me, that is you.
Oh, thanks, Catherine. The first time, right? It's like when we popped our literary cherries, and that's... I'm all here to talk about that, here to overshare.
Oh, excellent. That's a good starting point. I was actually trying to remember when I had first encountered your work, and I'm pretty sure it was The Family Law, which I absolutely demolished when it came out in 2010, and have just had the pleasure of rereading in preparation for today.
Oh my God. I just think about how a book over a decade old now has aged.
Oh my God. You know? it is aged really well. Like, it's so funny and so sharp. But I think the other thing is it's so full of love. And I think that is the best combination. And for me, it really echoes throughout your work. So I'm very excited to have you here.
Thank you. That's very kind. Well, that's the spirit with which that book was written. At least I remember it was.
Presumably, however, your work probably didn't start out so polished. We're going to start where we always do. What is the first thing that you ever had published?
Okay, the first thing I ever had published, I can say with great authority, was in Rolling Stone magazine as a teenager. Cool. Now, this sounds really impressive, right? Like, what, you were published in Rolling Stone as a teenager? Wasn't that made into the film Almost Famous?
So you're a prodigy.
No, it's not like that. So I grew up in coastal Queensland, the Sunshine Coast specifically. And this is a really white part of Australia, very coastal Queensland. Like, my family stood out. And the internet was very nascent. Like, we got dial-up towards the end of high school in my household. And really, my lifeline and my obsession and my connection to the outside world, even though I make it sound like prison, it wasn't prison. But, you know, like when you're not in a big city, when you're not in a city at all, and you are very much an outsider, you know, closeted gay kid, Asian Australian in amongst a sea of white, I just so craved to know and feel like I was part of the broader world outside of myself. So I was obsessed with magazines. That was my first kind of love. Well, after books, I mean, I loved books as a kid, but as teenagers, YA wasn't as good then as it is now, I reckon. And I just devoured and consumed magazines, especially music magazines, Rolling Stone. And I would be that really irritating reader who would write letters to the editor. And one time they published not only my letter to the editor, but I was a letter of the month and I won a Panasonic stereo. And I'm like, I'm one of five kids who didn't have my own bedroom. So my own stereo was a huge deal. And I'm like, wow, writing pays so well. I'm going to keep going on with that.
Oh, that's so cruelly misleading. I wish we were always paid in stereos, though.
Like, can you imagine? So that was my first kind of like taste at being published. And you never get over the thrill of seeing your name in print, but the biggest thrill is the first time.
Was that the only letter to the editor that you had published, or did you have, were you a prolific letter to the editor writer? Or
was I was a prolific letters to the editor writer, and I mainly wrote to Rolling Stone and Juice magazine. You know, these are titles very much of a generation, older millennial like myself or younger Gen X. They didn't get published. I mean, I doubt that any of them got published except this one. It was a very lofty letter about the Australian Republican movement and how it was unfair that people under 18 didn't get to vote for their own future about where this nation was heading. It was very self-important.
Oh, I love that. I wonder if there was a consistent tone to the ones that didn't make it, if you were consistently lofty.
Oh, probably just screechingly histrionic, as I'm sure this letter about the Australian Republic movement was too.
Okay, well, Ben, you cut your teeth on letters to the editor and earned stereos. It's probably always going to be a bit downhill from there. but you have gone on to write a lot of things, but also many types of things, one of which was The Family Law that I've mentioned, a collection of essays. We know it ended up as a TV show as well, but it started out life as a book. How did it come to be published?
I wish I could say that it was through my own talent, focus, and discipline, but it was sort of random. And I tell you this story not to kind of be frivolous or a little bit dismissive of the goal of writing a book, because I think it's such a thing that so many people wanted to do, but I didn't have that goal in my mind. I think I was very foggy about what a writing career looked like. I just wanted to be a freelance magazine writer for the rest of my life. I was quite happy doing that. But then there was a call out for an anthology from Black Ink Books called Growing Up Asian in Australia, edited by Alice Pong. And I'd read Unpolished Gem. I thought Alice Pong was just an incredible writer. And maybe with a little bit of hubris, I thought, growing up in Australia, Asian, that's me. I belong in this anthology. And so I wrote two essays for that. And they were kind of like in a David Sedaris style, because I was obsessed with David Sedaris at the time, kind of still am. And I just didn't hear back from them. And I just thought, oh God, like this is so embarrassing that I wrote these two pieces and neither have been picked. But as it turns out, it was because Chris Fike, the publisher at Black Ink Books, had read the two pieces, wanted to publish both of them, which was so incredibly flattering, and then said, do you have an idea for a book? And when I saw that email land in my inbox, my immediate reaction was absolutely not, because I didn't. But that's not what I wrote back to him. I wrote, absolutely, I do. Just give me a while to put my pitch together. And I just thought, oh my God, what am I going to pitch to him? And I knew that I didn't really have the discipline or the interest in writing kind of an A to Z memoir linear narrative. But what I could do is what I loved about reading David Sedaris's work, which was a collection or an anthology of essays. And in my case, it would be around my family. And so I pitched that to him and I got a book deal, and then I started writing The Family Law. But you see there, right? You see right there, like I did not have a plan. I just faked that I did, and someone very important believed me. And it was very similar to how The Family Law TV show came about as well. That was someone else's idea. It wasn't mine. I never thought that the memoir should or could be a TV show. But other people know better than me, and I'm enormously grateful for people like Chris Fike and Tony Ayres for seeing something before I did.
I think you have a good ability to say yes, though. That's also a thing to have in life to do well, I think.
I'm a shameless opportunist. Absolutely. And I think, like, especially when you're starting out as a writer or an artist more broadly, you have to have a period that's just aggressively almost saying yes. Before you even believe that you can do it, because you just have to keep the doubt inside, you know, don't let anyone see it. You just say yes and see what you can make of it. Like, there's never been a major project that I've signed up to where I haven't wanted to just completely back out, because I'm like, I can't do this. This is awful. Like, I'm not the right person. You don't want me. Can I give the money back? You know, I get to that stage with most projects that I sign up to. But you just don't show that. You just say, yeah, I'm really, really ready for this, and I'm the most qualified. I'm never the most qualified.
I think it's lies, illusions. I think that's great advice. You almost shouldn't have given it away. So you get the book deal. Uh-huh. How did the family react? Because it's not only a book deal, it's a book about them.
About them. That's right. I remember I was, we were all gathered at my grandma's place, I think. My mama's place, my paternal grandmother. And, you know, that's one of the places where we would reunite. I've got a very big sprawling family and we share news and we always celebrate each other's wins. You know, there is that kind of like Asian work ethic where like a work win is a family win. And I'm like, so guess what? I have news. By this stage, I've been writing for magazines, freelance for a very long time. Essays and comedic essays sometimes involving my family is a part of that portfolio of work. So they're kind of getting used to that. And I know which lines to cross and which lines not to cross. So I say, hey, I've got a book deal. And everyone was like so thrilled. And very next beat was, and it's all about us. And everyone's like, oh, okay. And I think to an extent they, by that stage, trusted my judgment and also trusted that I wasn't going to do anything reckless or exposing. And they knew the spirit with which I would be writing this book or anything else I'd written about them was never to expose, never to hurt, never to maim. But at the same time, we all know and acknowledge that intentions only count for so much. You know, you might not intend to hurt anyone in your writing or in life. That doesn't mean that they're not hurt. So for me, I did want to maintain an ongoing relationship with my family. And I was very, very mindful of how to do that and how to navigate it. But, you know, the old adage goes, you write with the door closed and you edit with the door open. You know, write in the privacy of your own headspace, within your own physical space, write exactly what you want to. The editing process is where you have to think about the real world consequences, but don't worry about thinking about them until then.
I think that's so interesting, that idea of boundaries and how you decide what you will and won't tell. Mm. Having said that, Ben, some of your funniest writing does relate to your mother.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Agree.
I mean, she's a real feature of the family lore, but you and your sister Michelle have also written Shit Asian Mothers Say. It feels like there's a lot of joy in writing your mum, if not the act of writing her, but kind of the character of her. Do you see those things as separate?
Well, in the case of the family law memoir, I mean, it is nonfiction, you know, like that is how I see my mother in real life. In the family law TV show, it's a fictional portrayal of my mother. She shares the same name and there is the same spirit, but it is a fictional retelling of my family story. And in fact, it's pulled into present day rather than recollecting the past. So there's no claim to authenticity or truth to it necessarily. And in some ways, when you start adapting something for screen, everything and everyone becomes their own creature. You know, like I don't have an experience of motherhood or parenthood. And so the two main writers I was working with, Kirsty Fisher and Sophie Miller, who, you know, were co-writers and script editors and showrunners of the show, you know, they are mums. So they had a whole other dimension of lived experience that they were able to bring to the character to kind of work towards a universal truth while keeping the character very specific, if that makes sense. So in that case, it very much was a character. And then Michelle and I have both written plays that aren't ostensibly about our mother at all, but are inspired by our mums. You know, like my family, people who know my mum, they know what parts of our plays are very much Jenny Pang and which parts are, of course, completely fictional. And so there is a spirit of mum that's in those works as well, but she's just an insanely larger than life character. And people tell me, whether they've read the book or seen the TV show, The Family Law, oh, you must be exaggerating. But then the people who know her are like, wow, you really gave a G-rated version of her.
It's a documentary.
Well, it's funny you say documentary, because years later I would make a documentary. I was part of a documentary called Waltzing the Dragon on ABC, which was a two-part documentary about Chinese-Australian history. And one episode involved me and my mum going on a road trip, and another episode involved me and my dad going on a road trip. And then people saw the real Jenny. And they were like, oh, wow, you weren't kidding, were you? So you can still watch that on iView. And my real mum is the person you see very much.
I'm going to fish that out.
Yeah. It's hilarious in its own way.
In the humorous writing about your mum, and I think one of the interesting things is, and I have thought about this in the context of, and I won't really go into it, but Chris Rock and the comments he made at the Oscar about Jada Pinkett Smith. Mm. I think it's very easy within comedy to have other people as the fall guys, as yeah. in that they bear the brunt of the joke. In your work, do you think about who the joke lands on?
Of course. And for me, I never want to make my mother the butt of the joke by any means, because part of what I'm trying to do is to kind of honor this woman who never got to tell her own story. You know, like for a long time, she was a single mother of five kids in a country that, I mean, wasn't really hers. You know, it wasn't the culture in which she grew up, and she was incredibly isolated and had no support network. And so I think about how much I owe my mother constantly, but also the outrageous and irreverent joy that she brought us through her parenting. And there were so many times as a teenager, especially, where I kind of sometimes resented my mother. I resented the life that we had because it wasn't a happy time growing up in a divorced household. And she struggled, you know, she struggled with the task of parenting, even though she did it really, really well. And I think part of it is like a love letter to my mum, and part of what I write is an apology to my mum. And she revels in the fact that she is kind of celebrated. And if people think that the jokes are a little bit off, well, she thinks they're really funny because they're hers in a way, you know? So when it comes to, you know, who's the subject of humor and who's the object of humor, you never punch down. You never punch down to people who are more vulnerable than you. I remember I interviewed David Sedaris actually before I started writing The Family Law, but after I'd gotten a contract. And so, of course, I used that opportunity selfishly and said, hey, what are your rules? You know, I didn't tell him I was writing a book. I'm like, well, but what are your rules for when it comes to writing about your family? And he said a few things. The first thing he said was, oh, I just tend to write about people who don't read very much. So they'll never read what he writes about them, which I thought was very funny. The other thing he said is, you know, the other rule, of course, is to not betray confidence. So if there was something funny that he'd heard from his sister Lisa, and if he wrote about it, it would show that Lisa had been indiscreet. He would never betray that confidence. And his other rule beyond that was you never make fun of someone unless you portray yourself to be the bigger source or focal point of ridiculousness. You know, you have to be the bigger clown or the bigger object of bad behavior. Otherwise, yeah, you simply come off looking like, and you are a bully.
Yeah. Empathy is, and I would say it of yours as well, but of Sedaris's work, he really gets close to stuff, but he's always that sense of empathy is always, and respect, I suppose, is always there as well.
Yeah. I mean, look, I doubt a lot of people would read Family Law and think very respectful account of one's family. But at the same time, I agree with you. There is a degree of reverence with which I'm writing in some ways. And I wanted to capture, you know, moments in time of my family, even including before I was born, in trying to understand them myself and also trying to convey them to a readership, to make this kind of like minority family who was kind of stigmatized growing up for, you know, being Chinese or being a divorced family, to make ourselves kind of comprehensible to people.
I want to come back to that, but before we do, I think it's really fascinating that the article, the column that you write in the Good Weekend, you roll a dice and people sort of dicey topics. So people are given a topic to talk about based on what number they roll. So it's things like sex and religion and bodies and politics. Mm-hmm. And I look at that list and I think it's surprising in some ways that you've come up with this concept, because you shy away from none of those things. Do you think in your own work anything is off limits?
Not really, actually. I have that column because I actually love talking about all of those things. Like, that's the point. I actually can't understand why you wouldn't talk about those things. I do think there's a sensitivity about money in most families, and maybe that's even an Australian thing, you know, like we don't want to be too candid about money. And certainly in my family as well, my father had ups and downs with finances, to say the least. And we were very shielded from that. There was very little transparency and therefore very little financial education and literacy in us when we were growing up. And that's something as an artist that has really haunted me throughout my adult life. Like, first of all, you're committing yourself to the arts, very little financial stability there. And second of all, I didn't grow up with financial literacy or stability necessarily. And so I think all of those things actually are the most interesting things to talk about. One, because I like talking about taboos generally. And two, actually away from the gimmick, I do genuinely believe that those six topics that I've chosen to base that format on are the most important conversations that we can talk about. You know, when we're talking about death, it's about how we think about mortality, how we treat each other in the living life that we have that's so fleeting and short and could be gone before we know it. When we talk about sex, it's like how we treat ourselves, how we treat each other, you know, how we interact with people, our lines, what turns us on, what interests us, you know. Like I find all of those things fascinating, and I have to give credit to that to my mom in a way, because I don't think anything really was too taboo to talk about growing up. You know, except like saying, "Dad's here, we love him." Don't say that. know, like, don't bring up your father. Don't bring up the war. But besides that, all of that other stuff, my mum didn't really see a reason why she shouldn't talk about sex. You know, she had five kids. It wasn't a mystery to her. So she was an outlier in Asian parents in some ways, and probably parenting in general.
Ben, I want to talk a little bit about identity. I'm going to throw a quote at you, something that you've said from a YouTube clip called Makers Who Inspire. Okay. And it says, one of the reasons I've switched gears so much with my work is partly because I find that fun and partly because I don't mind if you pigeonhole me, just as long as you pigeonhole me in a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. I love this. It's kind of subversive because the idea is you're only meant to be allowed one pigeonhole. How do you think having had multiple pigeonholes has helped you in being a writer and telling stories?
I mean, it's both helped me and hindered me in some ways, because no writer wants to be pigeonholed. But the thing is, I'm used to it, for better or for worse. Like, you're pigeonholed when you're so visibly different at school and in your community. In every school photo, I'm more or less the only, not just Asian kid, but non-white kid in the photo, maybe bar a couple of others. And it's just this sea of white, like you stand out and you're conspicuous. And I wasn't bullied for that in any meaningful way, at least, or, you know, people weren't colorblind, but they, you know, racism manifests in different ways simultaneously, and sometimes even manifests in friendly ways, which sounds weird, but I think anyone who's copped it kind of understands where I'm coming from. And so when you grow up being pigeonholed, you know, oh, the Asian kid at school, oh, you know, like the guy, blah, 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 blah. And that's why I think part of me being so closeted for so long was, yes, everyone was closeted in that age, but also I didn't want to be pigeonholed again. You know, I didn't want to be like that person and wear my label and my identities and be reduced to that. You know, it's one of those things when you're a minority, you both want your identity to be seen, but you don't want it to be 100% of who you are, because everyone else is considered a complex human being. Why can't you? But then by the time I'm a writer, I think I became a little bit stoic about it. Like, what's within your control and what's not? Like, the way that other people see you is very not in your control. And I just cared less, you know. So if you were going to pigeonhole me for being that writer, that Asian Australian writer, I'm like, that's fine. I'm also that gay writer. I'm also that millennial writer. I'm also that writer from Queensland. And I've been pigeonholed as all of those things. My whole, where I land with these conversations is less about being worried or being offended if people have pigeonholed me. I'm like, well, if they have pigeonholed me, that's sad for them. You know, they haven't looked closer. Or you flip it and you start talking about how Jonathan Franzen is your favorite white guy writer, which I, you know, which I actually agree with. He's one of my favorite white men writers. He's never described it that as that, is he? But it shouldn't be like, if I'm not going to take offense, he shouldn't be able to take offense. Or if I do take offense, he should be able to take offense. You know, like, if you're going to categorize me, categorize everyone. And if you're not going to categorize me, don't categorize anyone.
It's a bit like the parenthood question that's leveled at women. You can either never ask women that, but sometimes a more interesting question is to ask recommend that as well, or a more interesting approach
Absolutely.
Is to us.
Absolutely. I agree because it's my approach sometimes in taxis, which is like if I have a white taxi driver ask me, where am I from? And I'll say, I was born in Australia. No, where are you really from? And I'm like, so we're talking about ancestry. Well, let's start with you. Where are you really from? You know, because like unless you're a First Nations person on this continent, you are from somewhere. And our ancestries trace back to, you know, we have over 200 languages spoken here. And just because you're white doesn't mean you, like, you should be able to be, I should be able to be interested in your history as well. Not even necessarily as a challenge, but almost as a courtesy in the best possible way. We all have a heritage. Mine's arguably more conspicuous, but what's yours?
That's interesting. You've talked, Ben, about having grown up in a predominantly white community in Queensland. Mm-hmm. I guess the thing, we are of a similar age, the thing that was very obvious as a non-Queenslander in the 90s, say, was Pauline Hanson. And, you know, perhaps to some extent now, you actually got to interview her at one point.
Yes. Well, you really have done your research. Yeah, I interviewed her for Good Weekend. I forget which year it was, but she was running for New South Wales State Parliament. I forget which house, probably the upper house. And she wasn't successful then. And I just thought it would be interesting to kind of like be the person who just accompanies her on her campaign trail. Now, my advantage is my name is Benjamin Law. Mm. Law is a traditional Cantonese name, but at the same time, it could be a relative of Jude Law's, you know, like it doesn't immediately present itself.
Yeah, that's right. Love
as a
to
Chinese
be a
name
too.
So in my email signature, it's just Benjamin Law. I was lining up the interview with her through her team, speaking with this Queensland/Australian accent. They couldn't tell what I looked like. So when I'm rocked up to meet them, and I'm like, oh, I'm so pleased to line that up. Like, lovely to meet you. I knew what was going to happen. I looked like this, but I sounded like this. So already it started as a very interesting.
That's hard though. That's got to be hard too. Like, it's great.
Yeah,
but
hard for her or hard for me. I imagine more so them trying to wrap their brains around the fact that this Australian journalist that I've said yes to also happens to be Asian. And it, I think like it hopefully served as a reminder, like, why should you assume what I look like or what my ancestry was based on our phone calls or correspondence? And now that you do know, does that make me any less qualified? Does it make me biased? I mean, I would say that we actually all have our biases when it comes to how we view stories, and mine just happened to be a bit more obvious.
So interesting. Ben, we've focused a little bit on humorous writing today, but you've also done a lot of very serious journalism. I'm thinking of the Safe Schools essay you did in the quarterly essay, but also the documentary Deep Water, which for listeners was about gay hate crimes in Sydney where queer men were killed and pretty shockingly recently.
Yeah,
I don't
right
know
up until
necessarily.
The 90s.
That's right. I don't know why that makes it more shocking, but it felt very surprising. You did an interview for Liminal magazine. I think it was just after having worked on the documentary, and they talked about the importance of telling queer stories and educating about queer history. And you said, and I'll quote it back to you because it's really sat with me for a long time. The reason that it's important is because we weren't raised with it. If you come from an Indigenous or migrant background, for instance, you might be raised with the stories, dishes, languages, and history of your forebears. Not always, but often that's the case because your family shares the same background. When you're queer, it's likely you'll be raised by cishet parents and that you'll be the minority in your family, if not the only queer person in the household. So you don't grow up with that sense of queer family history and customs. You don't know your lineage. I found this so powerful and so moving. Having also, like, having an understanding of the documentary, though, that must have been a really difficult, this pretty difficult thing to engage with. How did you manage that? Was it difficult?
Well, I first moved to Sydney almost 10 years ago now, and I remember one of the cover stories for Good Weekend magazine was about these gay hate crimes that had taken place between the 70s and 90s. Now, when you think about Wyoming in the United States and Matthew Shepard, this is a young man who was killed in a gruesome, horrific, homophobic hate crime. And his name is synonymous with Wyoming. The play and the subsequent screen adaptation of the Laramie Project is based on that incident and how it shattered a town. And reading about this spate of gay hate crimes where, you know, so-called poofter bashing was a regular thing done by adults, but also teenagers in Sydney for such a long time. It was like almost considered a sport in some circles to go to beats to bash up gay men, queer men, and trans women especially. The fact that I didn't know that really shocked and shamed me, actually, because I knew about Matthew Shepard in the United States, but there were dozens, if not more than 100, cases like Matthew Shepard in Sydney, and I'd never heard of it or I'd never been aware of it. And these are prominent cases as well, you know, like a Channel 9 newsreader was one of the cases there too. And so I always was kind of haunted by that story. So when Darren Dale, a filmmaker from Blackfella Films, he and I found ourselves at a dinner and I said, I really admired his work. What are you working on at the moment? And he said, oh, we're working on adapting those stories into one, a documentary, and two, a narrative, a TV series. And I'm like, oh my gosh, like I have been obsessed with that because, and I told him about those feelings of like shame and fascination that those stories brought up in me. Why don't I know about my own queer history? And when you zoom out, I think this is a very Australian story in a way, not just the story of the gay hate crimes, but also the story of us not knowing. You know, this is a continent forged on an act of violent non-remembrance. It was in the colonial project's interest that no settler, no migrant would understand the full history of how this so-called nation called Australia was formed. And so whether it's feminist history, whether it's First Nations history, whether it's migrant history, whether it's queer history, disabled history, we bury. And if you even dare bring it up, people are so offended. And that offense comes from a deep fragility in us knowing that the foundations of this national story are deeply unstable.
It also just raises that question about, and I think about this in terms of Ukraine and Russia, there is something in bearing witness to the things that have happened, isn't there? Like in acknowledging
those truths. You need to bring them to light because it's funny you talk about this now because I hadn't thought about deep war in a while, but I was at a book launch the other night and I ran into Alan Rosendale, who's one of the interviewees in Deepwater, lovely gay guy who loves to read. So we see each other at book events and writers festivals. And, you know, the way that Alan was victimized in that period and involved in a deeply violent and traumatic altercation that could have very easily have seen him killed. I think about that constantly. And, you know, he is living testimony to the fact that this happened in our lifetimes. You know, this is not a remote kind of history. The people who perpetrated these crimes actually walk amongst us. You know, they've not been convicted. Very few of them have been found. And the fact that it has taken so long for one conviction of those spate of crimes to have taken place as of recently, as maybe early this year or late last year, just shows, you know, the effort that's put into neglecting these stories and to making sure they remain buried.
Ben, I want to finish on a positive note. I know you have a lot of fans. What is the nicest thing a fan or a reader has done for you?
It's definitely not the people who say, hey, Adam Liao, love your work. No, and I bring that up in good humor as well because, you know, if you're some sort of like publicly recognizable Asian, you've always been mistaken for someone else as you've been walking down the street. I think, to be honest, it was after The Family Law came out and then many, many years later when an anthology called Growing Up Queer in Australia that I edited came out, they both had similar reactions in that I had younger people especially contact me and say, oh, wow, you've just made me feel braver in coming out, in being myself. And to think that, you know, I guess I wrote and have helped create books that I needed to read when I was growing up but didn't have is kind of all you could ask for, really. And having that confirmed through people, that's satisfying.
Yeah, that's lovely. I can't help but add, what's the weirdest thing a fan's done for you?
Weird fan behavior is like, and this has actually happened multiple occasions now, Catherine, is when I'm like, I've just finished going to the gym or the pool and I've literally just showered and I'm dressing and my butt or my schlong is out. And they're like, are you Benjamin Law? And I'm like, wow, so now you want to recognize me and know my actual name? You know, you people usually think I'm Adam Liao, but now my, right, my dick is out and my butt's out.
It's a moment of clarity for everyone.
Now, yeah, now you recognize, I don't know, are those bits out on the internet or something?
That's amazing.
That's the weird stuff.
Benjamin Law, thank you so much for being on the show.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you like what you hear, please share the love on socials at The First Time Pod, on Insta and Twitter, or by leaving a review wherever you listen. To support our work in season 6, you can become a patron via patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast, or check out our work and upcoming events and workshops on katemildenhall.com or katherinecollette.com. We'll be back with brand new episodes in March 2023.